Coming up next on Renewing Your Mind.
There's a difference between simplicity and being simplistic. There is a simplisticness that's associated with much pop music, and also with much of the music that is now being incorporated in the church.
I think it's easy to recognize that the lyrics in worship music need to be biblical, but what about the music itself? Does theology influence tempo and tone? Thanks for listening to Renewing Your Mind on this Friday. We're wrapping up Dr. R.C. Sproul's series, Recovering the Beauty of the Arts. This week, he's helped us understand that art should be created for the glory of God alone. And contrary to modern standards, beauty is not just in the eye of the beholder. Dr. Sproul maintains there are objective standards. Yesterday, he talked about the influence that music can have, and today he'll help us understand how music is used in worship. Let's join R.C. now in the classroom with his lesson titled, Music, the Handmaiden of Theology.
As we continue now with our study of the Christian and the arts, an aesthetic, the concern for the beauty of God, we were in our last session looking at some of the elements of music as we applied the classical standards of beauty, the standards of complexity, proportionality, harmony, and simplicity, and so on. And as time ran out, I was talking about the element of harmony, and I mentioned in passing the advent of jazz music, which is indigenous to America, having its beginnings in Memphis, Tennessee, at Beale Street. And I'd mentioned that somebody in our audience had said that, well, jazz, it seemed to him, followed none of those standards of harmony and proportionality and so on. And I said, in fact, they follow all of it. And he said, well, I just thought that jazz was spontaneous. I said, well, it is in one sense. That if somebody would ask me for a definition of jazz in one word, I would use the term improvisation. And improvisation carries that idea of spontaneity, but improvisation does not mean a resorting to chaos in the use of music. In jazz, improvisation follows three kinds. One, there is an improv of the rhythm, where a song may be written with a particular rhythm in mind, and the jazz musician will use a little upbeat or driving beat to change the original rhythm, but nevertheless, it still operates in a rational manner. We also see one of the most creative elements of modern jazz is in what's called melodic improvisation. If you listen to jazz musicians, you will hear riffs where departure takes place from the traditional melody line. And the saxophone will go off, or the clarinet will go off, or the piano will go off away from the melody and play some funky melody. Yet that melody still corresponds mathematically to the basic structure of the song that is being played. It's not just completely free from structure or form. In fact, as I mentioned, many jazz players have first been accomplished classicists in their approach to music, and they learned not only the simple major and minor scales that we associate with normal music, so to speak, but they also pay attention to other kinds of scales. The blues scale is dominant, but also what's called modal scales in classical music. When we say the scale in the key of C, we go C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. But there are other kinds of scales that can be related to the same key signature, which are called different modes of the original scale. And they can get very, very complicated. The Phrygian mode and the Mixolydian mode and that sort of thing. And these jazz players have mastered these different modes of the scales and play them against the basic key signature. And what sounds like just pure spontaneity is done with this mathematical relationship intact. Now, the same thing with harmony. Let's just take a moment and look at harmony. When we talk about harmony, as I mentioned the other day, we talk about the relationship of more than one tone. Usually a major chord has three tones in it, like the C chord, a C, E, G. But you can build on that and have more tones in the chord that make it more full, more rich, and also at times more dissonant. And let me explain that for a moment. When we talk about these major chords, C, E, G, we measure them mathematically in terms of intervals. And an interval is the length between the two notes or the two chords. And you number this space between the two notes with the Arabic numeric system so that this becomes the number one note, and this is the number three note, and this is the number five note on the scale. And so all major chords are built on that same relationship. If I were to take the D chord, I would start with number one being D, and the third step interval from that would be, anyone? F sharp. And then A, thank you very much. But it's just, again, 1, 3, 5. And whatever key you are in follows that same numerical sequence. Now, as I said, you can add tones to these basic triads, like you can add a sixth, which in this case would be an A. Or you could have a seventh, which is a B flat, or a major seventh, which is a B, and even up to ninths, elevenths, and thirteenths. But all of that's what you get in jazz, where you get these extensive sounding, enriched chords that add to the basic structure of the music other intervals like sixths, sevenths, major sevenths, ninths, elevenths, thirteenths, and so on. But again, as strange as it may sound to us, it still follows a definitive mathematical pattern. Now, in addition to the math that goes into the interval structure of harmony that we see here, there's another kind of math that is introduced towards harmony, but it's spelled not by the Arabic numbers that I just used, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, but by Roman numerals. And I'm going to mention this for just a simple reason for a second, because what we're really concerned today with is religious music. These are Roman numerals, some of them with Roman capital letters and others with smaller letters. And these Roman numerals measure, again, mathematically and structurally, how harmony moves or how harmony progresses. Now, I'll be real simple here, but if we were going to take a C scale, which is the easiest one, C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C, you go up the scale, how many black notes are in there? How many black keys on a piano? In the C scale, how many black keys do you play? None. That's right. Because that's characteristic of that particular key signature, the key of C, that it has no sharps or flats. That's why it's so popular in the beginning stages of learning music, because it's simpler, it's not as complicated, because you just play on the white keys if you're playing the piano without any sharps or flats. Now, if I were to take the key of C and follow this progression, it would go like this. C is the first note, and that would be what's called the tonic chord, the tone that defines this particular chord. And then I go to Roman numeral 2, and it's in small letters, because in Roman numeral 2 means minor rather than major, so it would go to D minor, to E minor, because that's Roman numeral. Then the 4 chord is the F, and the 5 chord is the G, in this case a G7. The 6 is an A minor, and the 7th is a B diminished. Now, all that does is this, is that this shows the relationship of other chords that can be played on this scale without any sharps or flats. So remember, I showed you the D chord a minute ago, and it was D, F, sharp. But if you take that and change it to D F rather than F sharp, you've got D minor. Now, that gets complicated and very complex. But the reason I want to show you this little exercise is the simplest way to play a tune in popular music, in American music, is by restricting the chords to three of them. The one chord, the four chord, and the five chord. Any teenager who ever went out and learned how to strum a guitar learned this principle, because you can play almost every song there is with just three chords. The tonic chord, which is the one chord, the subdominant chord, which is the four chord, and the five chord, which is the dominant seventh. And so you go in this progression, you plunk on the C, then you plunk on the F, then you plunk on the G7, and the dominant seventh chord, or the five chord, is called the dominant seventh because it drives the music back to the foundation, back to the beginning, back to the C chord. So when you hear that dominant seventh chord, it signals the ear that to anticipate that the next chord you will hear will be the tonic chord again. Now, it doesn't always happen that way. Now, with jazz, you get far more complicated, and also in classical music, get far more complicated than this simple 1-4-5 arrangement. But one of the problems that we have in pop music is the lack of complexity, the sameness of these sounds. Where, as I said, I mean, a person can lead worship music with a guitar and literally only know three chords, C, F, and G7, or three other chords in a different key, and just keep strumming those three chords, and you can sing along with it and follow the bouncing ball, as it were. And so much of what passes for popular music and what occurs in church music is not only manifesting simplicity, but there's a difference between simplicity and being simplistic. There is a simplisticness that's associated with much pop music, and also with much of the music that is now being incorporated in the church. Now, in church music today, we've seen this revolution, and indeed a crisis that's caused quite a controversy about the introduction of so-called praise music as distinguished from classical hymnody. And I think when we look at the elements of praise music in our churches today, we see some things that are very good and some things that also are problematic. Now, I have to say, by way of introduction to this controversial issue, that my personal preferences for music are this. I like a wide variety of music. I love all kinds of different kinds of music. I like gospel music. I like country western music. I like popular music. I like jazz. I like classical choral music. I like bluegrass music. And right on down the line, just about every kind of music there is, I like it. I have in my car at any one time, I'll have choral music, popular music, jazz music and cassettes or CDs, and opera. I love opera music. And so I can't be accused of being fixated on one style of music. And as I said, I love popular music when I was a kid, and I still like popular music, particularly from that era. I'm not adverse to going out and buying Frank Sinatra tapes or Nat King Cole tapes that carry the best of Nat King Cole. But I notice this about it. When I listen to the popular music, even of the past, of my heroes and favorites, I can listen to it only for so long till it begins to bore me. It begins to weary me. Now, in contrast to that, when I listen to Bach or Mozart or the great classical composers, it seems the more I listen, the more rich the music becomes to me. The more nuances of sound I begin to experience as the ear starts to unlock some of the complexity that's there that is obviously missing from the simple music that becomes popular, rushes to the top of the charts, lasts there a couple of weeks, and then tends to fade into the distance. There is something about the reason why classical music is called classical is because it has endured the test of time. There is a richness, a depth of content to that music that continues to awaken the stirring of the soul as these elements of beauty become more and more recognizable in our experience. The phenomenon of praise song music, or sometimes, you know, in a jocular fashion, is called 7-11 music, where you have the same seven words repeated 11 times. And it just is so simple, so easy, that after a while, people tire of it, and they want more, something richer, something deeper. And yet, at the same time, there is a place for the very simple in worship. We wouldn't go on the mission field and go to a primitive tribe in South America, introduce them to Christianity, and right away say, now here's the way we want you to worship, with Handel and Mendelssohn and Bach and all of that, because they've had no experience in that. They're brand new Christians. And so you keep it simple. Just like the music that we have for children is very, very simple. I'm reminded of the discussion between the astronomer and the theologian. The astronomer was frustrated because he was a new Christian and he was trying to learn the things of God, but the theologian was too heavy for him. He says, you keep talking about all these concepts of theology like predestination, justification, supralapsarianism, and infralapsarianism. I don't have any idea what that means, and I don't even care. He says, for me, Christianity's simple. It's Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. And the theologian said, I think I know what you mean. He said, because I get confused when you astronomers are talking about exploding novae and quasars and black holes and this heavy matter and all this business. He said, I don't understand any of that stuff. For me, he says, astronomy's simple. It's twinkle, twinkle, little star. Well, that is what astronomy is to the child, twinkle, twinkle, little star. And yet there's some irony here that that well-known children's song, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, is taking and simplifying a little motif from a full-orbed Mozart composition, where that theme, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, that we would recognize, is produced in a complex, majestic way in that composition by Mozart. So there is a simplicity that goes with infancy, and yet as we grow up, we're expected to grow deeper as well as older. And the Bible constantly talks to us about leaving the elemental things aside and growing up into maturity, not being satisfied with milk as we were when we were infants, but to develop a taste for meat. And that same distinction can be with respect to music. That doesn't mean that somebody has to be a sophisticated master of classical repertoire in order to worship God in a way that is pleasing to God. But as we grow in our understanding of God, that growth should be, I think, enhanced by our understanding of the music that we use to accompany our worship. I know that people, particularly young Christians and new Christians, are deeply moved by singing praise songs. In fact, they sometimes almost swoon in their enjoyment of it. And I can enjoy a praise song from time to time, but there's got to be more than that as we grow in our understanding of the things of God. And so that's part of what this controversy is about in the church today. Let me just mention briefly an article I read recently written by John Hanna, who teaches theology at Dallas Theological Seminary. and is a member of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals, ACE, in which he gives a brief treatment of the role of beauty in worship and the role of beauty in the music that accompanies the worship of God. In this analysis, he borrows heavily from Jonathan Edwards. Remember, I mentioned at the beginning the aesthetic theory that began with Aristotle, then went through Thomas Aquinas, and then received the insights from the Puritan divine Jonathan Edwards. When we think of Jonathan Edwards, we think of sinners in the hands of an angry God. We think of a preacher who talked about hell, about wrath, and about judgment, and that sort of thing. Somebody not too long ago went through all of the works of Edwards and did a vocabulary analysis of Edwards and was shocked to discover that the two nouns that Edwards uses more often than any other two nouns were the words sweetness and excellence. And when he talks about sweetness and excellence, he's talking about the character of God and of Christ. And one of Edwards' most famous works is his book called Religious Affections, where Edwards, in understanding conversion, says that basically what happens with conversion is not something that is simply intellectual, but what happens in conversion is a radical change in the heart, a change in the disposition of the soul, where before the person was indifferent towards the things of God or towards Christ, now through the work of the Holy Spirit in conversion, that person now sees the loveliness of Christ, the sweetness of Christ. And in a real sense, the conversion of the soul is an aesthetic experience where the soul is awakened to the beauty of God. And the soul falls in love with that God. That's why Hannah argues in his article that we need to keep enriching the music of our worship, that we fan the flames of that affection that beats in the heart and keep calling attention to the beauty and the majesty of God. Again, all music that's ever been used in the church at one time was contemporary. So the issue today is not over new music versus old music. It's over good music versus mediocre music. And if we are to grow in the maturity, we should try to use the greatest music that we can find, the richest music that we can find, in order to elevate the soul to a worship of the beauty of God. Luther said that the handmaiden of theology is music, and that music has this powerful impact on the worship of the experience of the people of God. And that's why I think it's dangerous if we take simplistic music from the world and just bring it into the church without adapting that music to its purpose in worship. I think is a very, very serious mistake that the church is making in our day.
Elevating the beauty so that the soul connects at a deeper level. Such an important distinction made today by Dr. R.C. Sproul here on Renewing Your Mind. We're wrapping up his series, Recovering the Beauty of the Arts, on this Friday. He's explained with clarity and depth why the music we sing in worship should be taken seriously. You may already know that Dr. Sproul cares very deeply about this subject. In fact, over the past few years, he's been writing sacred music in collaboration with composer Jeff Lippincott. Dr. Sproul's theologically rich lyrics, paired with Mr. Lippincott's beautiful orchestrations, have created some wonderful new hymns for the church. They've released two albums. The first was Glory to the Holy One, and the most recent is Saints of Zion. For your gift of any amount today, we'll provide a digital download of both albums. Plus, we'll send you the 3-DVD set of the series we've heard this week. Make your request at renewingyourmind.org. or call us at 800-435-4343. Dr. Sproul's critical distinction between simple and simplistic is so important for us to understand as we think through beauty and art and music. We'd be happy to send you all 9 lessons from the series Recovering the Beauty of the Arts on 3 DVDs when you contact us with your gift of any amount. Plus, we'll provide digital downloads of Glory to the Holy One and Saints of Zion. Our phone number again is 800-435-4343, and our web address is renewingyourmind.org. Ligonier Ministries is taking advantage of the latest technologies to communicate the holiness of God to as many people as possible. And one of those new technologies is our smartphone app. When you request these resources, the 2 albums will be available to you to listen right away, both online and on the app. And if you'd like to download the app for your phone or tablet, simply search for Ligonier in your app store. Well, we hope you have a wonderful weekend. And as we celebrate the advent of Jesus Christ, it's important for us to understand why He came. Next week, we'll share several lessons from Dr. Sproul's series, Foundations. And we'll concentrate on the second advent. What do we know of the final judgment? That's all next week here on Renewing Your Mind.